live broadcast from Grey Duck Tavern. I'm talking this evening with the author Patrick Nathan to discuss his new work, The Future Was Color, a dazzling novel about the inextricable link between the personal and the political set against the decadence of Hollywood and post-war Los Angeles. Patrick is the author of Image Control and Some Hell, a finalist for the Lambda Literary Award. His short fiction and essays have appeared in The New Republic, American Short Fiction, Gulf Coast, The Baffler, and elsewhere. He lives in Minneapolis. Patrick, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
I think to kick things off, can you do a brief reading from the novel?
I can. All right. So nothing has happened at this point, and I am not going to tell you anything. All right, here we go. He left, the film still rolling, no one on the sidewalk. The day's heat had melted the sky into a syrup of an evening. In those days, there was a sameness to Los Angeles that nurtured rituals. The palms swayed, the convertibles honked, the dusk bound the city like gauze. He plucked a cigarette from the silver case. It was a good movie, he had to give himself that. The hideous spiders, enormous from uranium, moved like they were alive, and the flames that shot out of their eyes were believable. The burned bodies would give people nightmares, even the narrative held together. But it wasn't quite it, not in the way he'd imagined. They never were. Death from a bullshitted with people in pain. It's a play by America, though. Phone. Ticket booth gestured at the post. Want to see it again, mister? The bad for a week. Much of it removed the stupid little hat they made him wear, the sweat from his forehead. A scar rose higher like a sun. By now, George knew he was staring. He felt arrestable, deportable. But you can't necessarily.
Just tuning in, that was Patrick Nathan reading from his novel, The Future Was Color. Patrick, I wanted to start by asking you about the impetus for writing this novel. Tell us a little bit about your exposure to old sci-fi film posters at your favorite diner and how it inspired you.
Rest in peace, the bad waitress on 26th and Nicollet. They had all kinds of B-movie science fiction posters on the walls. This is sci-fi before Kubrick, sci-fi before Star Trek. Mm-hmm. And I had probably been there 1,000 times working on my book or just having breakfast. And there was a poster. One of my regulars called The Artists Are Waiting, that attributed to Laszlo Gorza, hung that why somebody, you know, why a Hungarian would be in Los Angeles in the 50s working on these movies. And it just kind of opened up from there. It was like a portal had opened and I saw the whole story. And yeah, I mean, you had these people coming from, George in the book calls them real cities, to come work on this American trash in Hollywood, basically, was how they kind of thought of it. You had these immensely talented people putting their efforts into these movies because nobody else would hire them.
Your previous work, Image Control, it examined the constant barrage of online content and its alienating effect on us and how that makes us more vulnerable to right-wing extremism. Did your research for that inform the writing of The Future Was Color in any way?
Oh yeah, I think a lot of the stuff that I read while I was kind of in the years-long freakout of working on Image Control definitely fed into this book ultimately. Especially a lot of the stuff like Adorno, Walter Benjamin, a lot of the Frankfurt School critics basically helped me kind of calibrate George's mind. And definitely a lot of the art history stuff as well, which factors, I think, more into the New York section than the LA section. But certainly they were in conversation in a way that I would not have anticipated had I not set out to write that other book first.
One thing that's unique about this novel is you eschew chapters and instead have four distinct sections with city titles and then breaks in those sections. I was curious to know why you structured the book this way.
I think not knowing it at the time, you learn a lot about what you're doing while you're writing the book that you don't necessarily set out to do. But I think I realized that where we live tends to have an enormous effect on how we are. And I think, Los Angeles, which is when the book starts, is the farthest west that George has gone in his lifetime. And it's almost the furthest away from himself that he is. And I did not realize this while I was working on it, but it's the perfect setting for the foreigner to be an alien. Because it's almost like he's visiting a strange planet and nothing makes sense to him, and he's just kind of sitting back observing these people and these environments and playing in his head with what he sees. And it then the New York section is very much him coming to the United States as a teenager and reinventing himself and enmeshing himself with a certain intellectual, like, painter kind of sect. And the Las Vegas section was just really fun to be total debauchery.
We'll get into that. So you just did a reading a little bit a while ago from the first page of the book. I was wondering if you could talk a little about the opening scene in Los Angeles and how it sets a tone for the themes of disillusionment and destruction that permeate throughout the novel.
Yeah, so there's the opening paragraph is kind of George that I did not read, of course, so as to be difficult. The opening paragraph is very much based in, like, George's kind of commentary on why he gets into writing these science fiction movies, is that he wants to be able to kind of showcase destruction. And I think it's the temptation of the kind of the easy fix, the blank slate, the new start, which is, what California is all about, for sure. And it's kind of this constant coexistence of history and historylessness. And was it Didion who said that California is the America of America? It's where everybody tries to, like, go to escape their past, and America itself is, the place everybody went to escape their past. And it's this kind of fantasy of destruction in the post-atomic age is very much wanting to like know what it would be like if we wiped the slate clean.
The motif of burning appears in the first pages of the book. What does fire symbolize for George's life and career, do you think? And is this somewhat metaphorical to the psychosis that lingers within post-World War II after seeing the bomb?
Oh, yeah. I mean, we want to burn, to be destroyed, or disintegrated. I mean, I think it's very much, the idea of purification by fire in a certain capacity. He fantasizes a little bit about floods and earthquakes and whatever, but I think it's fire that really captures his imagination, part of which is, activated watching newsreels of atomic bombs in the theaters in the mid-40s. There's just something about the idea of the fire sweeping across the landscape that captures him.
Los Angeles feels like a character in itself while reading the novel. How did you approach writing the city's atmosphere and its impact on the characters?
Oh, yeah, I mean, it was actually really easy to make LA feel like a character. Again, kind of going back to that earlier comment about it being the foreign planet of the United States in a certain way, and how it's embodies all these contradictions at once, and is especially for somebody coming from a major European city that has centuries of history behind it, to go to this place that is, all palm trees and beautiful new roads and wide lanes and overwhelmingly sculpted landscapes, stuff like that. It's very much it was easy to kind of make it as the charismatic setting in like a science fiction film.
Yeah. There is a palpable critique of Hollywood in George's reflections. How does his career as a screenwriter influence his worldview?
I mean, I think he's introduced to constraints that he would rather not have, just like most, you know, artists, I suppose. But he's working in the McCarthy studio system and trying very hard to kind of walk that fine line between here's what I want to do, here's what I want to say, but here's what I want to, or here's how I want to still have a job. And I think it's really his inner life that is able to give him that kind of respite from the constraints of the work, where he knows what he could say, he knows what he wants to say, and he carries around immense judgment of the people who prevent him from doing that.
I think before we move on, I was wondering if you don't mind reading another section from the book.
Sure.
In about 2 minutes, I think maybe in the New York or Las Vegas section, since you talked about the debauchery that happens there, I think that'd be exciting for all of us.
Oh, I know what I'm going to read. Okay. yeah. So this takes place at a party in a penthouse in Las Vegas later in the novel. And he's basically eavesdropping on a series of conversations. And kind of the best way to imagine this is just all these different voices happening at once. Why shouldn't we have the freedom to fly or display the swastika? It was only a symbol, a memory of the great ambitions of a country. Yes, the Germans got sidetracked, derailed, as it were, if you'll excuse the metaphor, which only occurs to me now as perhaps inappropriate. But you see what I mean, don't you? Let me ask you this. What do the stars and stripes symbolize? Agreement, analysis, logic, conclusions and such. Time spent, as it were, and often time wasted. But the swastika? Action, force. They saw what they wanted and they took it. They knew what would make them great. Surely you can understand that. If you ask me, a lot of people find it inspirational, even uplifting. They're just afraid to say so, cowed as they are by today's liberal intolerance. One used to be able to have a real discussion. It was unimaginable, simply unimaginable, to use a black olive in place of a green olive. Really, there should be 2 words, one of them an olive and one of them something else, something not olive. Hungary? Hungary's already passé, my friend. This week, it's all Suez. Nobody remembers Hungary anymore. To be interesting, that is the myth, or at least its virtue is mythical. You have all these people running around calling things interesting. Oh, isn't this interesting? Isn't that? Well, what else is it? Oh, those old bombs were so simple, not to mention there wasn't enough U-235 or fissile plutonium buried out there to wage even the daintiest all-out nuclear war. The Japanese are lucky. Even our early attempts were so feeble. No, these days we're able to maximize even depleted uranium and construct something unimaginably more powerful with isotopic deuterium and tritium. How much more? 1,000 times the strength of the Hiroshima bomb, and I say this conservatively. I suppose I shouldn't be talking about this, but it's not as if anyone could duplicate the design. Don't be silly. Of course Walt could trust Ronald Reagan. Masterpieces? Who needs them? Masterpieces are for people in their 20s. Give me an oeuvre, nothing. All this sweetness, the innocence and indulgence, the pies and the cakes and the syrups, it's all so disgusting. If you think about it, really think about it, the relationship between slavery and sugar is the core, the very heart of American hypocrisy. Maldonado, doesn't that mean bad gift? Nobody believes it when I tell them, but that's just how she makes her living. Just taking pictures of strangers in the street.
Very good. You're just tuning in. I am Josh Weber talking to Patrick Nathan about his novel, The Future Was Color. So George's, I want to ask you about the section of the book that in New York, George's internal struggles seems to intensify in New York. How did you intend for the environment in New York to influence his mental state?
I mean, I think New York, you know, New York has always been a kind of a pressure cooker of, I mean, the cliche, if you can make it there, you can make it anywhere. And I think him going there when he does, he just simply goes there as an immigrant to escape, you know, the Holocaust. But he ends up in this environment where you have all these other immigrants who left Europe. You have a burgeoning abstract expressionist art scene. You have 10 years of, oh my God, what was the program? It was one of the New Deals programs where they literally had artists make murals. So you have government-funded artists who have spent a decade practicing on government payroll. You have this enormous art scene, basically, and it was a really great space for him to not only kind of think about and discover who he is, because he's 16 when he comes to, but also experience kind of the immediacy of failure and kind of the disillusionment of he wanted so badly to be a thing and it didn't work.
The historical backdrop of New York in this period is richly detailed. How events shape your narrative choices?
So probably the driving factor of the novel in terms of when I decided to set it is very much the Hungarian Revolution in 1956. And then I kind of realized like I wanted to have this New York backstory of when he arrives as a teenager. And the Hungarian government was a puppet government of the Nazi regime until early 1944. And then Hitler was basically like, no, we're taking control. And that's when they had the largest single deportation of Jews. I think it was like 420-some thousand, less than 2 months. And that seemed to me like the time for him to leave Budapest. So it was kind of, that was kind of the bracket. And then everything else in there, including, you know, the last 6-7 months of the war being instrumental in how I shaped the rest of it. And, you know, of course, then you have all the art history that I was reading. Mary Gabriel's Ninth Street Women is an amazing book that I, like, could not have written this without. And Jed Pearl's New Art City, Art in America, that, you know, great books, you know, read. they're just, I every time I'm reading something, I'm putting little, like, stars in the margin, being like, ah, I could use that.
Las Vegas is depicted with a unique sense of desperation. What inspired your portrayal of the city?
Just how much I hate Vegas. you know, no offense to anybody who's listening, but you could live somewhere else. There is another reason, the part of Las Vegas, but it's just the perfect place to have total night, you know, like what Vegas, maybe New Orleans, but New Orleans is actually fun.
Then among the characters of Vegas revealed deep, what messages were you hoping to convey through these dynamics?
Well, you know, I just read that part about the guy with the swastika, you know, kind of trying to make the case that it's just a symbol. And I think it was that party in particular was such a fun way to put just the worst ideas into people's heads and have them
just run amok.
Yeah, run amok and just be all over the place. And it was almost this ventriloquism that was happening because, you know, you exist in the 2020s here and you overhear or read a lot of questionable beliefs, and it's really easy to then translate those to another time and have them revealed as the absurdities that they are.
There's an undercurrent of tension throughout the Las Vegas section. How did you build, as a writer, I'm curious to talk about how you built, sustained that tension.
So my favorite thing, I think, so far is that everybody who's read the book has told me that they did not see it coming. And I think part of that was keeping that party scene so frenetic, so all over the place, that it is jingling keys, you know, to keep your gaze focused on something else. And it just really was this intense energy. And of course it's fueled by drugs and alcohol. I mean, not me, but the characters are all taking Dexedrine, which was a very big amphetamine at the time. They're, of course, drinking. And then some acid makes its way into the mix. And it was just a really great, I mean, it's a 40-page party. And it's a whole experiment for me because of something like that. And it was wonderful to have it be so frenetic.
The cultural differences between America and Europe are stark in your narrative. How do these differences influence joy and growth?
Yeah, I think kind of going back to what I said earlier about the farther he goes west, the further away from himself he gets, and then he retreats back east and kind of comes back into himself. It very much, to me, feels like somebody who goes on a journey and feels like the whole journey was a mistake and feels like they went away from themselves, but of course he had no choice but to go away from himself. So it's kind of like a situation of well, this is how I lived, wish I had done that differently, but that's what it is. It was kind of a really, the cliche is so fatalistic. It's, this is what it's like and this is who we are and I wish I could be different, but I'm not. Versus Americans, you turn 73 and you're like, guess what? I'm gonna get into skiing, or I'm gonna start growing weed. That we're told that we can do anything at any time in this country.
You just made me realize how American I am.
Oh yeah, no, totally.
I feel like I'm thriving on feeling reinvent myself every day.
Oh totally. I mean, it's we're a self-created country of self-created individuals, and that is admirable and remarkably lonely.
It is an isolating experience. George's reflections on cinema and art deepen in Paris. How do these reflections tie into the broader themes of the novel, do you think?
So he, goes to Paris. He gets affiliated with an unnamed magazine that is Cahiers du Cinéma, and is present in Paris, right at the Nouvelle Vague of Godard and Antonioni and all these very famous years. And I think he kind of lets go a little bit of the fantasy that it's going to have a very wide impact on American life. And I think he goes deeper into what kind of personal relationship you can have with a work of art. And I think too, now I'm just totally making this up as I go, but I think he's lived enough by that point that he has that much more mature understanding of how a person actually is affected by and also not affected by a work of art. I think, again, kind of going back to that cute little line from the party, masterpieces are for people in their 20s. There is that moment when you're in your 20s when every new thing you encounter feels like, oh, this has changed my world. Mm-hmm. And when you get to be in your late 30s, early 40s, you're just kind of like, it was pretty good, I've seen better, but
My last trick, Paris, and the narrative arc.
Isn't it just so natural as we get older to think more about the past? But I think he feels like somebody whose past was stolen in a sense, because he comes to America at 16. His entire life at this point has been erased. And I think he, as much as he regrets his time in America and as much as he is, as much as he wishes he had become somebody else or done something else, I think he also values that, I was there and I did do that and I met these people and I had these experiences. And I think that's part of why he's telling his story to the person who is then telling the story to us, the reader, because the whole book is relayed through another person. And it is kind of this sense of, just somebody, another person. It's
a dime top novel, Color, and published by Counterpoint Press. Patrick, thanks so much for asking me to do this. Thank you, Grey Duck Tavern, for hosting, and Subtext Books for bringing us out here. And forgive me, what's the address for Subtext Books?
6 West 5th Street.
And 6 5th West Street?
6 West 5th Street.
6 West 5th Street. Please go there to buy your copy of The Future Was Color if you cannot find a store that has it. And thank you, everyone, for coming out to support Patrick.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much. And now this.